Welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Florence Reed. Reed is an environmental activist for sustainable farming and rainforest protection. She was a Peace Corps volunteer in the early 1990s, where she was stationed in Central America. It was there her environmental activism began to take hold. She created an organization called Sustainable Harvest International in 1997. The organization addresses the tropical deforestation crisis in Central America by providing farmers with sustainable alternatives to slash and burn agriculture. SHI has reached more than 1,800 families in 120 communities in Honduras, Belize, Nicaragua, and Panama. I'm speaking to Florence Reed by phone from her office in Maine. Florence Reed, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now, were you already feeling the stirrings of environmental activism when you joined the Peace Corps in the early 1990s, or was it that experience that prompted your activism?
No, I would say that my Peace Corps experience focused my activism, but I think that it really started at quite an early age, maybe as young as 5 or 6 years old, when I would go hiking with my parents and camping and visit the Bronx Zoo with them. And those types of experiences as a child, I think, got me started quite early on the path to being an environmentalist.
Well, were your parents teaching you about the environment and about your surroundings? Is that what got you interested?
Well, they gave me many opportunities to appreciate the environment by taking me hiking in beautiful natural areas and taking me to the Bronx Zoo on a regular basis to learn about and appreciate the animals whose habitats were endangered and those sorts of things.
So you did join the Peace Corps in the early 1990s, and I understand you were stationed in Panama. What was that experience like?
It was really a wonderful experience for me. I'll always be grateful to the Peace Corps for that experience. I was stationed in a small rural community in the Coclay province in Panama, a community called Santa Rita. And what really came home to me during my years as a Peace Corps volunteer there was the fact that things I had studied in college about rainforest destruction were true. It was true that small-scale farmers were causing a lot of the deforestation because of slash-and-burn farming. But what really came home to me during my years as a Peace Corps volunteer was the fact that the farmers did not want to be destroying the forest. They valued the forest, and they were looking for alternatives to the slash-and-burn farming that would be more productive for them and would allow them to grow on the same land every year. And so that was something that I think really shaped my future thoughts in forming Sustainable Harvest. And the other thing that I think really came home to me was the fact that changing, really profoundly changing the way people feed themselves, especially if it's something they've done for generations, that it's not something that can be done in a week or even a year, that it really has to be a long-term process. And so those were, I think, some of the key things that I brought out of my Peace Corps experience.
And so did you learn a lot of your skills that you transferred to Sustainable Harvest International in the Peace Corps?
Yes, certainly. The development of our field program and the way we do the work in Central America with the farmers in the rural communities was very much influenced by my experience as a Peace Corps volunteer.
And so was Sustainable Harvest International, was it your intention to form this organization in order to focus more specifically on the issues that you were interested in?
Yes, exactly, because when I came out of the Peace Corps, I came out really wanting to work for an organization that was dedicated to providing long-term technical assistance to farmers so that they could move away from slash-and-burn farming and move to farming practices that would be more productive for them and that would preserve more of the tropical forests. And I was completely shocked to find that there was no such organization out there because it just seemed like such an obvious need. And so at that point, fresh out of Peace Corps, I didn't feel ready to start a new international organization. So I worked for a couple of other organizations first and learned a lot that way before finally moving on to starting Sustainable Harvest International in 1997.
And how did you pick the communities that you were going to participate in? And how did you build trust with some of these small communities?
Well, initially, the first communities that we started working in were communities that I had connected to when I was working with other organizations, and then when we started work as Sustainable Harvest International in these countries, we did so by partnering with local organizations in each of the countries. So, for instance, in Honduras, which was the first country where we started work, we started out by partnering with a local environmental organization called the Fundación Ecologista Héctor Rodrigo Pastor Fasquel, and they were focused on preserving a forest in the watershed for the city of San Pedro Sula. And they were interested in partnering with us because a lot of farmers were going in and burning down the forest inside this nature reserve. And so by partnering with them, we were able to tap into their local knowledge, both of the country of Honduras and of the communities surrounding this nature reserve, and they were able to get us started there, and then from there on out, word just sort of spread through the grapevine, and it was a similar situation in the other countries as well.
Mm-hmm. And I would assume the challenge in some of these countries is the fact that there's a lacking in education in regard to sustainable land use, but also where do these people get resources?
Resources, what type of resources?
Well, to do sustainable farming, you need tools and seeds, and how do you navigate that?
Really, primarily what we offer is technical assistance, and I think that knowledge is really what's most needed for sustainable farming, and one of the things that appeals to me about what we teach is that it is a low or no input system, and the farmer can do most of the things that we teach with only a machete. You'd be amazed how many things a Central American campesino can do with a machete. When I was in Peace Corps, I think we came up with a list of 99 things we had seen a machete used for.
Wow, that's amazing. You might be able to translate into some practices in this country.
Right, it's impressive. So Sustainable Harvest does provide the farmers who work with us a certain amount of seeds if they're not able to obtain the seeds themselves initially, and then we teach them how to save the seeds or make sure that they're able to have access to a supply of those seeds into the future. And in some cases, we'll provide some limited materials for other projects, such as maybe drip irrigation or for wood conserving stoves that we help many of the families build, and that sort of thing. But really, most of what we provide is knowledge through the technical assistance that we provide to the families.
Mm-hmm. And tell us what sustainable land use practices actually consist of and what was missing in their education in regard to that.
Okay, well, the families that work with us traditionally practiced only slash and burn farming, and for anybody who's not familiar with it, it's more or less what it sounds like, where a farmer will go in, cut down an area of forest, burn it, grow their crops there, but they can only usually grow them for maybe a year or two, and then the ash that has provided some nutrients for the crops is quickly washed away during the heavy tropical rains, and the topsoil is washed away also, and there's not much topsoil there to begin with. And so then they have to pick up, move to a new area of forest, cut that, burn that, repeat the cycle, and so on. And I think it's a growing system that probably worked well when it was a small indigenous population and they could leave the land to recuperate for 50 or 100 years.
But
now the population's so much larger, the land's not distributed equitably. These small-scale farmers are often farming on steep slopes, so the erosion happens even faster. And then they have to go back after maybe only 5 or 6 years, and whatever's grown back, cut it again and burn it again. And each time they repeat that cycle, more of the topsoil is washed away. And usually in fairly short order, the topsoil is completely gone. And that's the point where they have to either pick up and move to an area where there's virgin forest and start the process over again there. Or they often feel forced to move into the city to look for work, which is often in sweatshops or other horrible conditions, and they're usually living in shanty towns and awful conditions in the cities. Or they may try to have a family member come up to the U.S. to look for work. But, of course, if they do that, they usually have to do it illegally, and there's all sorts of risks involved, and even best-case scenario for them that the family member is able to find work and send money home. The family is still separated for months or usually years at a time. So they're really anxious to find a way that instead of having the productivity of their farms go down every year, that they can actually have the productivity go up.
That's really amazing to me. Did it seem like magic to some of these people that they could learn how to nurture the land so that it wouldn't be destroyed?
Yeah, you can see it on their faces when you go to visit them, or when I've gone to visit them, and they show me a hillside where they used to do slash and burn farming and grow corn, and it used to look almost like a desert, and it was turning to a desert, and they were buying more and more agrochemicals every year to try to keep the production going on this land, and then finding that productivity was still going down, and they were only making maybe $90 when they'd sell all of their corn. And then they work with us for a few years, and then they're able to show us that by learning the techniques we teach of using things like cover crops and erosion barriers and things like that, that now they can pick up these handfuls of rich, dark soil on this hillside that used to be almost a desert, and they're able to sustainably grow new crops that are earning them maybe $2,000 a year in or a season instead of $90 that they used to earn, and they're obviously thrilled to see those changes and to see that they can farm on that same land indefinitely for generations into the future.
Wow, that's really quite something. Now, I want to ask you this: the Sustainable Harvest International volunteers are they working really hard to leave a light footprint themselves? How do they live in these communities?
Okay. Well, the majority of the work in the communities is carried out by our Central American staff. So we have 50 or so Central Americans working for us full time. And so these are the people that are providing the technical assistance to the farmers, and they're the ones that are really carrying out the work in the communities. Now, to complement their work, we do have groups of volunteers that go down on our smaller world trips, and these groups of volunteers will go for usually a week or maybe 2 weeks, and they will support our local field trainers and the families working with them on specific projects. So, for instance, if there's a community where several people are switching from growing their rice on burned hillsides to learning to grow their rice in rice paddies, and they need a lot of extra hands to dig those rice paddies initially, we'll bring in a group of volunteers who will provide all that extra labor to dig those rice paddies to help the families get started.
Do they just stay with the families, or do they camp, or how do they live?
It varies. In many cases, for part of the trip, they will stay with the families. We'll split the group up usually into two people per family for the families they'll stay with, and so they will have that homestay experience to really get a sense of what life is like for the families who work with us, and then really get to know the families. And then part of the time, or instead of that, depending on the situation, that they may all be sleeping on mattresses on the floor of the local health clinic or a local school. And then we have a few trips, and we're trying to do more of these, that are geared towards groups that want a little more comfort than that, and we'll have them stay at a nice eco resort where they can have nice comfortable beds and good sheets and gourmet meals in the evening, but still from there have the opportunity to go out to the communities and spend the day in the community getting to know the families, getting to see firsthand the projects that are being carried out, and help with them in some way.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Florence Reed. She's the founder and president of Sustainable Harvest International. Now, Florence, I want to ask you this. I'm sure you've been asked this before. Considering the economic downturn, especially in this country, why not use your energies and experience to help some of the struggling communities in the U.S.?
We do get that question occasionally, and I do sometimes wonder if we should be bringing our program here to the U.S., but the reason we have not done it and may not do it is twofold, I would say. One is that there are a number of organizations providing similar assistance here in the U.S., and we don't want to duplicate another organization's efforts or compete with another organization that's already providing this type of assistance to families here in the U.S. And the other reason is that we can get so much more done for the same amount of money in Central America. Each one of our Central American field trainers works with an average of about 45 families. And the cost to maintain, to carry out all of the work for one of our field trainers for a year is about $16,000. And so that's paying their salary and their benefits, their transportation to the communities, paying for the seeds that they give the families and the other materials and everything else. And if we were to do the same thing here in the U.S., you know, it would be at least five times the cost. And the impact is greater, even though I know we do have real problems with people living in poverty in this country. The poverty is much more dramatic in the areas where we work, where people are living on less than a dollar a day. And the environmental impact, I think, that we can have is also greater, because not only are we improving the environment on the farms themselves, but we're also providing that additional bonus of protecting the forest that would otherwise be slashed and burned for new farmland when the original farmland is depleted. So I feel like we can provide a lot more bang for the buck by doing the work where we do it, and that there are other organizations providing good assistance here in the U.S.
I understand that. That seems perfectly logical. Now you're also concerned about food security. What exactly does that mean? Tell us more about that.
Well, when we start working with families in Central America, we very consciously start out by focusing on teaching them the sustainable farming practices for growing their traditional staple crops so that they'll be able to meet all of their families' needs as far as eating their traditional staple crops. And then our second focus is on helping them add some pieces to their farm that will allow them to provide a balanced diet for their families so that they're not eating just corn tortillas some days or just tortillas and beans or just rice and beans. But we'll help them with organic vegetable gardens so that they can get the vitamins that they need in their diet. And maybe we'll help them with chicken coops so they can have more eggs so that they'll have protein in their diet if there's not beans available year-round. And so our first focus is on making sure that the families can provide a decent diet for themselves. And then it's later in our work with them that we shift our focus to adding in crops that they can also grow for cash income so that they can pay for education for their children and health care and other basic things that they need.
Now, I understand that some of the techniques you use, it goes through several phases, and it takes approximately 5 years from beginning to end. Do you end up wanting some of these communities to be self-sufficient?
Wanting them to be?
Yeah.
That certainly is our goal, is for all of them to be self-sufficient. After the 5 years it is over and the families graduate from our program, so to speak, our expectation is that they will continue on their own, continue to make improvements on their farm, continue to see their standard of living go up, continue to protect the local environment and global environment through the techniques that they have learned, and also to some extent help their neighbors to have the same success that they've had. And we are starting to see that this is happening in Honduras, our longest-running program. They recently went back and visited some families who graduated 2 years ago from the program, and they found that about 95% of them had continued on with all of the sustainable farming practices that they had learned with us.
That's impressive. But how does self-sufficiency manifest itself in these communities? Do people grow enough crops so that they can go sell them at markets? How does that work?
Yes, the families that work with us are self-sufficient in that they're growing all the food that they need to eat, or almost all of what they need to eat. And then beyond that, they are growing crops that they can sell primarily in local markets and in some cases also to some export markets.
That's very impressive when whole communities can become self-sufficient in that way. Now, there are often unstable political structures and governments in some of these countries. Did the politics ever interfere with some of your work?
I haven't really found that the politics has interfered with our work. And I think that is a sign that while there are still problems, that things have been improving in Central America. I know particularly when I first started working in Honduras, I had a number of people say to me, if you'd been doing this work back in the 80s, you would have been killed by now. And so that was a little distressing to think that was the case, but it was also encouraging to see that had changed. And the higher-up people in the countries just ignore us and are not particularly interested in what we're doing, but they're not standing in our way either. And the rest of the people, the vast majority of the people in all the countries where we work are extremely supportive.
That's great. That's great to hear. You often hear about, people with great intentions getting kicked out of countries because of politics. So, now, how do you raise funds for your organization?
Well, the majority of our funding comes from individual donors, and the people just hear about our work and see the value of it and make donations. And we also have some businesses, especially smaller businesses that are tied to organic foods and those sorts of things that tie in with our work, who donate to us, and some foundations as well, particularly the smaller family foundations.
Tell me on a personal level how working with Sustainable Harvest International and some of the work you've done has changed you.
It certainly makes me very grateful all the time to be able to be doing this work.
That's a stymie, huh? You have to talk about yourself.
Yes, I wasn't ready for that one.
Well, I just wonder how people are affected, because this is obviously your life's work, and it seems to me you're going to continue doing it. I was just wondering how it has enriched you.
Well, I certainly do view this as my life's work, and I guess from the time that I started it, it definitely showed me that I have a greater capacity to for hard work and long hours than I previously would have realized. I think because Sustainable Harvest is sort of my baby, particularly in the early years when 70 and 80 hour weeks and 365 work days a year were sort of necessary to get it all up and running, I was perfectly happy every minute of it, and that's not something I might have expected if you had asked me about it beforehand.
Yeah, you don't seem like the type of person who wanted to have a 9-to-5 office job.
No, definitely not, and I definitely feel very lucky to have the work that I do have.
Mm-hmm. Now, how does your organization find and screen volunteers?
The volunteers that go with us on our smaller world trips for a week or two, that's pretty much open to anybody who wants to go with us and who can pay the costs for going on one of those volunteer trips. And the majority of our volunteers do go as part of these smaller world trips. We do have a smaller number of volunteers who will go down on their own for longer periods of time, and those people are treated sort of like hiring a new staff person. They're going to fill a particular need in working with one of our affiliates in Central America, and that they have to show that they have the right experience and background and knowledge to fill that role. So it's very much as if we were hiring them for a paid position, except happily we don't pay them.
Do you give any kind of trainings in regard to sensitivity, in regard to certain rituals and customs in particular countries?
Yes, definitely. both for the volunteers who are going on their own and also for the volunteers who are going in a group with one of our smaller world trips. We provide them with written materials and also opportunities to talk with us before they get on the ground, so that they are able to participate and be in the communities in a culturally sensitive way.
Mm-hmm. Have you had any major obstacles during these 13 years?
We've certainly had some obstacles along the way. I don't know that I'd said any of them were major, and I imagine that they're similar to any the sort that any organization has. Our biggest obstacle, I think, is always the fact that there are so many families asking to work with us, and that we're not able to reach them until we can hire more field trainers, and we aren't able to hire more field trainers until we can increase our funding. And so finding the additional funding, I think, has always been the biggest obstacle for us.
Mm-hmm. And do you think you'll ever reach a point where you'll be able to put Sustainable Harvest International out of business because you've been so successful?
Well, yes and no. What I envision as our ultimate goal, the way we work in each of the countries is that we set up an in-country affiliate. So, for instance, in Honduras, we now have a Fundación Cosecha Sostenible Honduras, Sustainable Harvest Honduras. Mm-hmm. They have a Honduran board of directors. They have, you know, their own executive director who manages the program in that country. And so they're starting to do much of their own fundraising. And so we don't need to do nearly as much with them as when we were first starting work in Honduras, and now we're starting to replicate that in the other countries where we work, and that's freeing up resources so that eventually we hope we can start programs in other countries. And then in the very long term, I'm hoping that Sustainable Harvest International will remain relatively small, but be the hub of a large global network, and we'll just sort of facilitate the flow of information and resources amongst these affiliates around the world.
Very, very wonderful organization. Well, we only have about a minute and a half left. How can someone get involved with Sustainable Harvest International?
Well, they can go to our website at sustainableharvest.org to find out more about our work, to find out about volunteer opportunities, to learn how to donate to our organization. They can also phone us at our office at 207-669-8254, and we always welcome help from volunteers, both volunteers who would like to go down to Central America, as well as volunteers who would like to help us here in the U.S. And as I mentioned, the need for additional financial support is always great as well.
Well, Florence Reed, thank you so much for joining us. Once again, I've been speaking to Florence Reed, founder and president of Sustainable Harvest International, and we wish you great luck in the future, Florence. Thanks for the great work.
Thank you, Tish.
Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. If you'd like to make a tax-deductible donation in support of the Out of Bounds radio show, please contact our fiscal sponsor, the Arts of the Southern Finger Lakes, at earts.org. That's earts.org. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And visit us online at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.